The Sunstone Foundation presents Military Mormon Missionaries and Their Contribution to the International Missionary Experience. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Gentlemen, it looks like we have more up here than there are down there. That's all right. We'll go ahead and enjoy it and hope you do too. I'm Virgil Kovalenko, the moderator of this panel, which is sponsored by VASA, which stands for Veterans Assisting Saints Abroad. We are an organization independent of any other, founded by LDS veterans of the Vietnam War. To begin this presentation, I'll give a brief introduction of our association known as VASA, and following that, each member of the panel here will make an opening statement. Your symposium guide program lists the names and a short biographic statement of each one of us. VASA is a nonprofit, tax-exempt, War Veterans Charitable Association of Volunteers. It was founded in 1982 by LDS veterans of the Vietnam War who discovered that members of the church were still alive in Vietnam. Those faithful Vietnamese saints had no channel through which they could receive spiritual or temporal assistance. Since that simple beginning, helping only one LDS family in Vietnam, we are now recognized internationally through the various humanitarian projects we sustain. Primary in those projects is assisting in the reunification of families separated by war. Also included in our efforts is helping to heal the wounds of war through medical, agricultural, and education programs. Although we began with a concern for one LDS family in Vietnam, the experiences of the past 7 years include responding to requests for help from the U.S. State Department, as well as representatives of the LDS Church and other major denominations. We have provided assistance to transient veterans and their families stranded in Salt Lake City. We also have accepted cases involving families from Burma, Ethiopia, Iran, Iraq, Hungary, as well as the Southeast Asia countries of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Our purpose here today is to discuss the value of faith in a profession often perceived as being R-rated, or where moral values are in short supply. The working title of our presentation to you today, other than what you read in the brochure, in the program, is R3 equals S3, or Mormons in the Military, Can Faith Survive in an R-rated Profession? Our range of experience stretches from World War II to the conflicts in the Middle East. The opportunities for missionary service while in uniform are unlimited. Each panel member has his own experiences from which he formed his life's values. Each of us has been touched by the injunction of every member a missionary. We in VASA, although independent of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, do not feel it necessary to apologize for, defend, nor cast aside our beliefs in the church and those values which sustained us during combat and now in our daily lives. We want to state at the outset of this panel that we are not here to restate, rehash, or relive the war. We do not speak for the Veterans Administration, the Vet Center, any outreach program, or any other group. Although we are cognizant of the realities of problems many veterans continue to suffer as a result of their experiences in Vietnam, this panel is not the forum for resolution of those problems. We appreciate the opportunity in this symposium to present a view of the military as a career for a member of the LDS Church, a view which is often ignored. As for myself, my military experience began during an ROTC summer camp with the Arizona National Guard in 1948. I wore the uniform of the U.S. Navy for 8 years of enlisted service and the Air Force for 21 years as an officer. I participated in numerous special programs and assignments in Puerto Rico and many of the Caribbean nations, in Panama, in Vietnam, and in the Middle East, in the Yemen Arab Republic. Concurrent with each military assignment were ecclesiastical positions, some in small branches, others in large wards. While in Vietnam, I served simultaneously as a political warfare advisor to the Vietnamese Air Logistics Command, and as the LDS Serviceman's Group Leader at Binh Dinh Air Base. Through my military career, there have been times of severe testings of the teachings, the values, and the structure which I had usually accepted by faith, nothing questioning. But when the questions began, The values were challenged in many ways. Through those periods of what I call my wilderness experiences, there evolved a conviction that sustains my acceptance of the church. During one particular severe rocket attack in Vietnam, there came the calm assurance that if we continued to do our religious duties, all would be well. That calmness, that assurance, cannot be quantified nor measured. It just was. And that has not changed. I value my military career as having provided some of the most exciting missionary experiences I could have ever imagined. Please now hear from my colleagues on the panel. We will begin with Gordon Weed, one of the founders of VASA. You just stay right there, Gordon. I'll hand you the microphone. Gordon will be followed in order by Marty Keller, over on this end, and Roger Clausen, then Harold Wilstead, Phil Flammer, and John Norton. We've placed Colonel Norton in the cleanup position because of his background and an unusual experience which changed his life. Following their opening remarks, we'll be pleased to entertain questions from the floor concerning VASA, our projects, and the Mormons in the military experience. We will close with the questions and these proceedings of this panel and other remarks. I say at 15 minutes past 12, it may close earlier than that, depending on how vocal you are and what you want to know. We'll have some wrap-up comments and some announcements of interest concerning special projects currently in progress in Utah. We have some handout materials that you might be interested in. If so, you may ask. We have also as a resource gentleman here, Mr. Keith Haynes, who will be making a specific announcement at the conclusion. So now we will hear from Gordon Weed.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm sorry that there weren't more people interested in this subject of veterans assisting saints abroad. Can you hear me okay back there? My life has been affected by the three wars. My daughter refers to as the Olden Day War, the World War II, the Vietnam War, of course, and then in the interim, the Korean War also affected my life. I was old enough to be drafted in World War II right out of high school, and prior to that, we had the option of enlisting in one of the services. I had wanted to fly ever since I was young, so I selected the Air Corps at that time, the cadet program. And I was elated when I qualified for pilot training, got basic, was headed for pre-flight, and the war ended. I was a little bit upset. I thought it could last a little longer than that, at least to the point where I could have flown a P-51, which I'd always wanted to fly. And as I was discharged at the convenience of the government, they told me that if I waited 6 months, the program might open up. And I was delighted to hear that. So I prepared myself to go back into the Air Force and fly airplanes, which I had always wanted to do. But a bishop came along and intervened and said, at this stage of your life, you should go on a mission. I said, no way, Bishop. I'm not going on a mission. I'll put that off until later. I want to go fly airplanes. Well, he promised me at the time that if I would do the Lord's work and serve him in that capacity, that I'd be able to fly all the airplanes I ever wanted to fly. So I accepted that and went to Sweden on a mission. When I came back, there wasn't a program open. There was no possibility at all of getting into military flying. So I kind of considered commercial flying, because I always did want to fly, so I entered the university, and lo and behold, the Korean War broke out, presented the opportunity to get in the ROTC program at this university. I graduated in 52 with a degree, and I also had my commission and the opportunity to go to flight school. So that was the inception of my pilot career. We entered the Air Force in 52, and from that time on, various and sundry assignments throughout the states. We had the opportunity to be involved in groups, branches, wards, and stakes, and we always took advantage of the opportunity to serve the Lord, because this promise was unfolding, that if you would do the Lord's work first, he was bound in that respect to look out for you and your interests if they were in line with his sanction. Well, lo and behold, here again, the Vietnam War broke out, and I was at various assignments in support capacities. Then came the time to go over there for a full year as a fighter-bomber squadron commander at Benoit Air Base. And that's when the fun and games were over. The stark and harsh reality of combat faced us at that point. The first time I ever pressed the button to release 1,000 pounds of destruction on enemy forces was devastating to me. I couldn't believe that all of the things I'd been involved with and all of the enjoyment of training and going out to the bombing range and using practice ordnance became a reality. And I asked the Lord at that time, before I got totally involved in this, that was this necessary because of the attitude toward the Vietnamese War and the attitude of the civilian populace toward it. And I was given the calm, serene assurance that whenever you're involved in helping people establish and maintain freedom, that he certainly did sanction this, and it was past the negotiation stages, and now we had to engage in combat. I flew 436 missions in a year, and Monty Keller, where's Monty? Right here. I'd been over in Vietnam for a considerable time at Ben Hoa, and I got a call from Monty, and he said, "Gordon, I'm over here as a meteorologist and working at 7th Air Force headquarters. I'd like you to go on a mission." I said, "Fine. I've flown two today. Which one would you like to go on?" And he said, "No, I mean a mission for the church." And I said, "Monty, I'm up to my ears as a squadron commander with Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, 400 civilian people to work with. I got 8 airplanes down with combat damage. I'm working 18 hours a day, and you want me to go on a mission?" I said, "I don't think I can do that, Monty." He said, "Remember your promise that if you put the Lord's work first, that all these other things would unfold. I'll be over next Tuesday and set you apart." Next Tuesday, he arrived, and he introduced me to my companion, who was a specialist fourth class, Bruce Johnson, from Long Binh Army. And Brother Johnson had just come out of the bush. He was scroungy. He had mud on his boots. He was sweaty. He just barely made the appointment. I had just showered into my clean flight suit from my air-conditioned trailer, and I looked at Bruce Johnson, and Monty said, "This is going to be your companion." I said, "Monty, I can't fraternize with Army enlisted people." He says, "Stop complaining. I'll make him your senior companion." So I shut up, and Monty set us apart. He gave us a blessing that I'll remember to this day. He promised that if we would do the Lord's work and do the missionary work as assigned and whatever other assignments that we had in reference to the Lord's work, that not only would I be protected, but the men under my jurisdiction would be protected. And I, after the blessing, I said, "Monty, do you realize what we are exposed to over here and what you just said?" He said, "I know." He said, "It wasn't my prompting to say that. But that promise is there." And I will tell you that we had some incidents that were miracles that were predicated on that promise. And I know that you can do the Lord's work in conjunction with doing and serving your country. I've got testimonial after testimonial where men were protected, not only those under my jurisdiction, but I came out of there without a scratch. And for those of you who know what low-level close air support is, every mission you're exposed to heavy ground fire, intense enemy sophisticated weaponry, and I brought airplanes back that shouldn't have flown by virtue of normal structural standards, but I can bear testimony that there is and will always be. Not that those who did die and who were shot down and were captured didn't have meaning, but in my case, that blessing unfolded. And I want to let you know that. Time is about up.
If you'll pass that down to Monty, we'll now hear from Monty Keller. This little buzz that you hear, by the way, is your timer.
Okay, I didn't hear it.
I know. That's right. So that's why we let you go on a little bit longer.
And I've just turned mine down, so I can't hear it either. So. Appreciate Gordon's comments. I wanted to just say a few generic things, and then if we got into some questions and maybe some specific things. But I've been out of the service for 10 years. I served a little over 20 years. Spent assignments in the United States at 6 different places and 5 different places overseas. Spent some time in the Antarctic, New Zealand, the Philippines, Okinawa, and Vietnam. All of those experiences were choice experiences. I wanted to just take a moment to talk about missionary service in general. As far as I'm concerned, missionary service is Christianity in action. A missionary serving the Lord and doing what he's been taught to do and asked to do by the mission president and others must speak and act as the Lord would do. Now, any profession in life that offers opportunities to do that is certainly favorable for a fruitful missionary service. It's my opinion that the military profession certainly offers that opportunity. It's not unique. There are many professions that do the same, and all professions should do that. To me, I can't separate missionary service from just living the gospel principles. You can't separate those easily, I don't believe. I think we've all been placed here on earth to do a few important things, and I've just listed a few. To build faith, have spiritual experiences like Gordon has had, and many others. An opportunity to develop your leadership capabilities, to be a part of an earthly family and develop those ties that can exist throughout eternity. To serve others more than serving yourself. And a part of that, of course, is carrying others' burdens. I think that's a key part of service. Also, to build a financial structure that you might support yourself and your family. To be able to work constructively with others is certainly an important reason for being on earth. To learn new concepts, to learn the truth. And then probably the most important, and that is to have an opportunity to use your free agency. All of those, I think, are important. Each profession should offer you an opportunity to exercise those things, which will eventually develop us to a point where we can be happy with our family forever. Now, the military profession isn't unique in offering the opportunity to do those things. However, I found there are about four things that the military did offer my family and I, and I like to just list those, which are very important, I think, in affecting good, positive missionary experiences. I think one is by virtue of your moves every 1, 2, 3, 4 years in the military, you're placed in numerous situations, different people, all types of challenging situations that you have an opportunity to exercise the principles of the gospel. That's an advantage, I think, to do effective missionary work is giving you the opportunity. Our 2-year missionaries, our 1-year, whatever it might be, certainly have that that opportunity for their 1 or 2 years. I believe in the military is one profession that you can have that opportunity for 20, 30 years. Another key thing is it's so important in missionary work understand those that you teach, those that you're trying to convince to change their lives. I don't think there's any better way to affect that and understand that better than to have your family with you in a location long enough that you are able to understand the needs of those that you're teaching. And certainly there's opportunity for families to go together throughout your career. The military is an excellent ground for testing you. There is ample opportunity to be separated from your family where you don't have the support direct support of your wife, your children. You're on your own, and it's either live the gospel or don't. So there's many opportunities to do that in the military. And finally, it seems wherever you go in the military, there's great opportunity to lead. There's always new converts, and usually more new converts in the areas you go in the military than there are if you stayed in some of the more established areas of the church. So there's great opportunity to teach and to lead. And I don't know as I would recommend military service to others, but for myself and our family, we had many great experiences, and I appreciate my service in the military.
Thank you, Marty. Microphone now passes to Roger Clausen, also a Vietnam veteran, and then it'll come back around this way. I'll put this thing again. Did you hear that, by the way?
No. You got to turn that up.
It has no controls other than it tells it's time. Roger?
I, too, am a 20-year veteran of the Marine Corps by virtue of the Navy ROTC program here at the University of Utah, which I entered in 1956 with no thought whatsoever to making a military career. It was just a good scholarship and way to get my way paid through school. And after I served the required 3 years, we got out, almost as, like I was programmed to do so, and been out about 6 months. My wife and I looked at each other and says, hey, we really enjoyed that. What are we doing here? So we turned around, and fortunately I was accepted back in and went on to complete 20 years of service. The title here is being a missionary or being a Mormon in an R-rated profession. I might take a little bit of exception to that because I found the profession to be in many ways very principled. Many of the men that I served with and served under were highly principled individuals. It was surprising how many of my fellow officers were very religious. I found a number who had studied for the Roman Catholic priesthood, and due to running across a young lady that caught their eye more than their commitment to the profession in the Catholic Church, they got married, and one of them told me that the discipline of the military was quite appealing, since that had been a factor in their consideration for the Catholic priesthood. So I found a lot of colleagues who appreciated the spiritual aspects of life. And I found that being a Mormon in the Marine Corps was not a burden. Now, I was told when I was going through OCS by a captain that stood up in front of us and told us if you didn't drink, you'd never be successful officer in the Marine Corps. Well, about 15 years later, I saw him discharged as a major for alcoholism and went on to surpass him in rank. And I found it to be an asset. If you stand by your principles, whether somebody agrees with them or not, you certainly are going to be applauded by most of those around you, especially if they do have any principles at all. I recall an occasion in Guantanamo Bay in 1962, just prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was sitting with a friend who... there in the BOQ, he used to invite me to come sit at the bar with him, and while he'd drink, the bartender made an excellent lemonade. And a few days later, I was up in a room kind of kibitzing a card game. Some of the other officers were playing, and they all ordered drinks, and I ordered one of these lemonades. And this friend of mine was not in the room at the time, and he came in while I was in the middle of drinking that drink, and when he saw it, his first reaction was that I had an alcoholic drink in my hand. He walked up and took it away from me and took a taste of it and handed it back to me, and he said, boy, am I relieved. His values were such that social drinking was fine. But it brought home to me the fact that other people feel comfortable with others who are living their principles and the values that they espouse. So it was an experience that I valued highly over the years. I found missionary opportunities to be great. Never had to ask the question. I was always asked. I had an opportunity to baptize many people and their families, serve in many capacities in the church, from the Far East. I was a group leader at Da Nang in 1965-66. Served while I was a captain, serving as a communications officer for an infantry battalion, one of the first that went in that beginning of that war. And went back to the Far East several times after that without the family. And the Marine Corps was kind of notorious for sending you off for year-long stints with leaving your family behind. But there was those years were spent very productively, and both my family and I look back with great fondness of those 20 years. I asked my children one time after I'd been retired a few years living in Farmington whether they would have preferred to have grown up in a community, a stable home life. They were unanimous. He said, "Dad, we're glad you chose the path that you did." And so I felt that that certainly made it worthwhile. My wife, I think, would have stayed on active duty much longer than I did for her enjoyment of that. But it was an excellent experience, and in many ways, almost always, fortified my faith and my convictions. And I never really had to feel like it was a challenge or that I had to equivocate at all in maintaining a successful profession of arms and my membership in the church.
Thank you.
Harold Wilstead is our next speaker.
To start out with, my remarks may be determined somewhat by the nature of the audience here. Let me ask, how many of you are LDS? And how many? Okay, it looks like everybody is. I am, unlike the other members of this panel, I was on active duty for just over 3 years, including the Vietnam era. And since that time, I've been in the Army Reserve. I'm the Vice President and General Counsel of VASA, the Veterans Assisting Saints Abroad. In the military, I am in the Army Reserve currently, serving as a military attaché to Norway, a reserve attaché. So I have the opportunity of going overseas once in a while for a couple of weeks at a time, and it's a pretty nice way to get overseas and have someone pay you in the same at the same time. In Vietnam, I served as the LDS group leader in Thuy Hoa, which is on the coast about halfway up up country in South Vietnam. Like these others, I had some great experiences in Vietnam as an LDS serviceman. We don't really have time to spend a lot of time on all of those, but let me just refer to one incident that might illustrate some of the blessings that LDS servicemen, I think, get, and others who follow the commandments of the Lord. I flew reconnaissance missions. Gordon over here talked about his fighter missions and his ground support missions and so forth, and the fire that he came under. When you're flying reconnaissance, you're looking for the other side, basically. You're trying to find him. And he's trying to shoot you, but you don't have anything to shoot back with. My analogy is that it's like two gladiators. Gordon went into the gladiator ring with a sword, and the other gladiator was there with a sword, and they engaged in combat. In reconnaissance, you go into the gladiator's ring and the other guy has a sword and you have a piece of parchment and a stylus to draw his picture. our planes took hits about 30 times during the period I was there, and we were under mortar attack about on four occasions. But we didn't actively engage in trying to kill the other guy, and that suited me just fine. I felt going into Vietnam like I didn't want to kill anybody particularly. But at the same time, I felt like I had an obligation to take the risks that the other troops did, and so that's how I got into aerial surveillance. On one mission, we had just returned from a surveillance mission. They take about 4 hours, and we generally monitored the Ho Chi Minh Trail with electronic equipment, infrared and side-looking airborne radar, or just regular cameras. It was the typhoon season, and we were about out of fuel
and had to make a landing within about 10 minutes. But there was a terrible typhoon in the area, and we were just at the tail end of it. The tail end of the typhoon was over our airfield as we were due to land. We didn't have a radar approach. We just had interlocking metal runways with no radar approach or anything like that. So we did a radar approach to an air base, an Air Force base close by. And then we're going to do a visual over to our own airfield, which was about 4 kilometers away. But as we descended to come in to about 100 feet altitude, our windshield frosted over. And the defrosters didn't work. We had a lot of problems in our planes with things not working. But the defrosters didn't work, and we couldn't see out the windshield. And the airplane has a bubble, and so it would look out the sides of the bubble trying to see what was ahead of us. And as we made a visual approach over after the radar approach to just get down to 100 feet over this airbase, and then a visual approach as we swung around to come into our airfield, I reflected back on what was the movie? Trying to think of the name of the movie. One of the movies about the time of Christ, where you may recall they were on a ship and they went into battle and the ship sunk, and the guy that was the star of the film saved the captain of the Roman Empire. Was that Ben-Hur? Okay. That movie came to mind at any rate because I could see we were in deep trouble with this. We had crosswinds of 22 knots, which were the maximum we could handle in daylight in good weather, and this was the middle of the night, about midnight. It was pitch dark. We couldn't see out our windshield. There was a 22-knot crosswind. As we approached our runways, so the runway lights were in series, and one of the lights had burned out, which meant the whole series of lights was burned out. And unbeknownst to us, the base was on an alert for an impending attack. So anyway, we came down and started to settle over the runway, and as we started to settle to touch down, a gust of wind came and just knocked us off to the side, and so we came back over the runway and started to settle down, and another gust of wind knocked us over to the side, and we settled over the runway a third time. By this time, we were more than halfway down the end of the runway, and this time, no gust of wind came down, and so we touched down, but we touched down kind of hard, and we bounced about 12 feet back in the air, and then slammed down on the runway again. And the pilot reversed the pitch on the props. And normally you've got a synchronization there, but for some reason that didn't work very well. And the plane suddenly lurched toward the center ditch. And he just took the stick just like this and just brought the airplane back over. And we slammed down on the runway a third time. And we taxied in. But I definitely felt on that occasion that our Heavenly Father was watching over what was happening, and that my non-member friend in the cockpit there was the beneficiary of some of those blessings, just like Ben-Hur.
My name is Philip Flammer. I went into service in a roundabout way. After high school, I went to start Utah State, but my eyes read, but my mind didn't, and so I received more F's my first years of college and all the grades combined. Wasn't a bad kid, but I didn't, just my mind didn't absorb, and I was a very despondent person. A chance came through to fly for the Navy, and I thought this was the Lord now directly intervening. I went out to San Francisco, passed the mental test. Now I knew the Lord wanted me to fly for the Navy, and then in the physical, my heartbeat went to 145, and it stayed that way for 5 days. No blood pressure change or anything, and the doctor was so totally perplexed that finally he said, "Well, I'm very sorry, we can't use you." So I was walking down to the train station to come home. My pulse was normal. I then realized that the Lord did not want me to fly for the Navy. And with all respects to the Navy, my depth of character was shallow enough at that time where I might have been in some moral danger. At any rate, I just decided I wanted to go on a mission. I did. Went to Switzerland, found my love for history. Came back, burned my way through college in 2 years by studying all the time, even on dates. And took an ROTC commission because I needed the money. And then I went into the Air Force to pilot training. I intended to get out as quickly as possible. But I had three of my seven great religious experiences in my life came in the air. And I don't have time to go into those, but they were dramatic, kind to all our lives. In the service, we were preparing to get out. I go back to graduate school. we had a chance to go to Washington and work D.C. and work for a fellow who was a writer, a very hard taskmaster. I was afraid of writing, but I decided if I worked for him and got by him, that would be I would have gained some real benefit, which turned out to be true. I got my master's at night and was ready then to get out writing letters to universities when a friend suggested I ought to talk to the Air Force Academy about teaching. I flew out, and they said, well, we've had a change of curriculum. How soon could you get here? So I went to the Air Force Academy and then decided that I would begin searching a Ph.D. dissertation, and then if I'd taught about 4 years, I'd go to school and do that. After 2 years, they invited me and wanted me to go to Yale University, which frightened the heck out of me because I didn't think I was Yale quality. But it had to be at Yale, and it had to be in military history. We finally decided it. That we would, although my wife and I had made the firm conclusion that if the family was ever in jeopardy, we'd junk it. That was our thing. I went to Yale, did well, surprising a lot of people besides myself, and came back to the academy and then applied for a fellowship to Oxford University and got it, which really astonished me, and now I was going to be the historian's historian. I realize now that I had some capability and I was the only Ph.D. military historian in the United States. I had to go to Vietnam first. That's what the dean decided. And as I sat down and plotted this out, I could see no possible reason why I should go to Vietnam. I could fly, but there had to be some training. But my real expertise was in history, writing history. But anyway, so I went over there. I went as a historian. But this now, the most spiritual experience in my life took place. And this was because each day as we traveled to and from the billet to the place where I worked, we passed right between the 3rd Field Hospital in Saigon and the helicopter landing port offloading wounded and dead. And I saw that so often, I became mesmerized by it. And then I began to realize that even as I'm seeing this, where a person is wounded, perhaps dead, the family back home doesn't realize this. And out of that came a conviction of how transitory life really is. And I lost totally and completely my desire then to be the historian's historian. Now I'd be a teacher, someone who said he devoted his life to other people. Concurrently, I'd been working with the Vietnamese, particularly in getting a girl who wanted to teach, wanted to stay in the United States, back to the United States. I came back from Vietnam after having been this historian and finished out my career at the academy and then at Maxwell. But what came out of Vietnam was a great compassion. I'd always kind of had some of it myself, but this seeing the lack of need there, I think there, I still kick myself for not having given a lady who was trying to sell a half a watermelon. She had a baby on her hip. And I just bought the camera, and she probably traded away for a small sum, but I still kick myself for not giving her that camera. At any rate, the result was we eventually wound up sponsoring the branch president's family, which we went up the airplane expecting to get 3, we got 11. And we worked in getting those amalgamated and so forth. I only heard recently about this thing, but it fits well with the desires I've made in my life. People in the military wonder how a civilian like me could possibly survive. My civilian people wonder how I could possibly survive in the military, so I'm probably neuter someplace. But I'd served 7 stake missions while I was in the military. At the Air Force Academy, we had a higher baptismal rate than any of the stakes in Colorado. And a lot of it was based on example, the cadets and so forth. Brief thing, and if I was flying some people in a very heavy thunderstorm in an old B-25, and I was mad at them because they had made the plane real late, so I kind of went through the thunderstorm deliberately. But there was one of the fellows, very sick, comes up to me and says, Flammer, I want you to know I'm glad you're flying this airplane because I think they're a good person. The Lord won't let anything happen to you. Well, that's a privilege to be to be here and to be with this group.
Thank you. We've saved the best for last. All of us have had experiences, and some of which we're going to talk about in a little bit, but we want now John Norton to share with you some things from his perspective as one who did not grow up in the church and had no contact or any concept of what is a Mormon until what he wants to tell you happened. John?
Thank you, Virgil. I approach this with a great deal of humility here because the experience that I'm going to share with you is one that's, as you'll see, is a very personal one, but it's also one that I think we can all relate to, and it also certainly, I hope, dramatizes in a way what we're all about in the military as Latter-day Saints and trying to be missionaries and hopefully give others the kind of experience that I enjoyed some 16 years ago. As Virgil said, I was not LDS growing up. I grew up in a military family, though. My father was a very successful career officer. He retired in 1975 as a three-star general, and you can say that my father's been a very strong motivating force in my life. Probably partially because of that, I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point and graduated in 1970. And upon graduation, with the Vietnam War going on, also kind of threw my hat in the ring to go to Vietnam. Going to Vietnam and into combat without the perspective of the gospel, I realized then that I was not spiritually prepared to deal with a lot of things in Vietnam. I initially served with the 101st Airborne Division in the fall of 1971. And Vietnam was kind of an interesting time then because the war was winding down. It was clear that the U.S. was gradually going to start pulling people out of there. And so commitment was starting to wane. And the ferocity of the war was also, I guess, becoming less and less. And I was tempted, I guess, to come home with the 101st in January of 72. It would have been a good way to kind of get out of there in one piece and sort of have credit for being in combat for a little while. But I was given an opportunity to go down and serve with the Vietnamese Airborne Division. That was, in some ways, kind of like joining the World Series team or the Super Bowl champion. The Vietnamese Airborne, at least among the Army, was kind of a real elite outfit, and it was a chance to serve with the best that the Vietnamese had to offer and also serve with some of the best fellow Army officers. And so I thought that was kind of a neat opportunity, and I went down there. Several months later, though, I all of a sudden realized that I was maybe getting in over my head because in March of 1972, those of you that remember the war began with a renewed ferocity from the standpoint that the North Vietnamese Army attacked South Vietnam with three major attacks, and all of a sudden what had become kind of a tranquil, good life in Saigon that I was enjoying all of a sudden became a real hell on earth, and I was quickly kind of thrown into the fray and went from one battlefield to another with the Vietnamese airborne that I was assigned with, trying to sort of block the North Vietnamese attacks and trying to sort of regain control of the chaos that was sweeping the country. I had experience in July of 1972 that changed my life, or at least you might say planted some seeds that later changed my life. I was involved in a very tense combat situation where we had been trying to conduct an attack for most of the morning, and when those attacks were repulsed, we began to use our Air Force help in putting in airstrikes on the North Vietnamese positions and trying to sort of soften them up. And then later that afternoon, as we were kind of trying to get reorganized to resume our attack, and the air had now gone off station, it was late in the afternoon, the North Vietnamese turned around and gave us back what they had been receiving for several hours, and that was a very heavy bombardment of mortars, artillery fire that on our little hilltop, it was estimated that we received somewhere between 300 and 400 rounds of incoming during about an hour period of time. Right on the corner of the foxhole that I was in, and when the explosion went off and I was engulfed in the blast of this thing, My last recollection was that I'm out of here. This is it. That was it's all over. And as I began to regain consciousness several minutes later, I thought to myself, I wonder where I'm going to be when I open my eyes. And then as I began to regain consciousness, totally amazed that I was still here and still in one piece. And we regained control of that attack that we were under, and it still looked like we were going to receive a major attack that evening by a large North Vietnamese force that was far larger than us, and that brought me to a point in my life where I kind of felt like I was at kind of an all or nothing situation, and so I, as things quieted down and as the sun began to set, I got out of my foxhole and I did something that I'd never really done before in my life, particularly since I'd been in Vietnam, I found a place there where I could be alone in a little bushy area that I could have a little privacy. And I got down on one knee and I pleaded with Heavenly Father that if He would somehow rescue me from this situation and kind of get me home in one piece, that I wanted to dedicate my life to His work. I didn't know Heavenly Father then, and I probably knew Him as God, and I didn't know any idea what His work might be. But again, it was sort of a situation where I said, "Hey, look, I'm desperate, and I've only got one person to turn to, and I want you to know that I'm totally sincere about this, and if you'll help me get out of here alive, I'm willing to do this." I also thought to myself that I wasn't above dying for the Vietnamese people. I love them very much, but I felt like I had a higher destiny in life. Well, I got back in the foxhole, still sort of expecting the worst, although still hopeful that what I had done would be worthwhile. And the next thing I knew, I had fallen asleep, and then I was being awakened, and the sun was just coming up. The night had passed, and we had not been attacked. In fact, we had received some small probes, but we had been ordered by our higher headquarters to withdraw from the battlefield with all of our dead and wounded and come back to kind of rearm and refit. Well, that was on the 9th of July, 1972, and on the 12th of August, about a month later, I landed safely at Travis Air Force Base, my year in Vietnam over with, and I'm home safe and sound. And one of the thoughts that came to mind as we landed at Travis was, okay, John, you're home safely now. What about the promise you made on that hilltop? Yeah. Well, I was off to learn to fly helicopters and off to have a good time. I was single and kicking up my heel out of crazy things, and it wasn't until March, almost a year later, 1973, I'm in flight school, and I go out to fly one day, and because of some instrument fluctuations, we landed the aircraft, precautionary landing at a little airfield there, and had the aircraft checked out. And while we were waiting to get the aircraft repaired, I got into a discussion with a young man who, unbeknownst to me, was about a six-month convert to the church, a young Army warrant officer, instructor pilot, and we had a discussion that began and was sort of conducted along sort of philosophical lines about where man came from and why we're here and where we're going to go, and that all led me into kind of wondering where he came from. I mean, where was he sort of basing these ideas on, a lot of his thoughts, and of course, as he shared with me that he was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I had a very sort of dumb look on my face because I had never heard of that church before. And then he said, "Well, you've heard of the Mormons, haven't you?" And I said, I had no idea there was any correlation. As we talked about the Mormons, and I was very curious about them, I asked him to share with me where the Mormons sort of got started, and that led to the Joseph Smith story. And I'll just close in saying that as he was sharing with me the Joseph Smith story, as I listened to his description of Joseph kneeling in the grove with the experience with God the Father and Jesus Christ appearing to him, my first reaction to that was I have to say, negative, in that I sort of was incredulous that he could believe that this could happen. And then as the negative thought passed through my mind, my thoughts were taken back to that little hilltop in Vietnam, and words came to my heart in a very loud and clear way that, John, this is my church, and this is your chance to fulfill your promise. And so on the 23rd of March, 1973, and with that experience that I could tell you more about now, but that planted the seed that led to my baptism 3 weeks later. And over the years that I've been a member of the church and been in the military, I've witnessed some wonderful things, and I've enjoyed some wonderful personal growth. As I was thinking up here a few minutes ago, if I went back 17 years ago, one year prior to my conversion, I would say without any doubt that I was the least likely of anyone in this room to ever join the Latter-day Saint Church, so it gives you a little idea of my background. I'm now a professor of military science at Brigham Young University and have a chance to serve there and have a chance to try to raise up young Latter-day Saint men and women as well as other good men and women to be Latter-day Saints in uniform and to do the kind of things that we need them to do in the future. I definitely have a challenge ahead of me. I've been there 2 years now, and I would appreciate any ideas that others have here, the things we need to be doing there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Now that's a background from our standpoint of those of us who have served in the military either a short time on active duty or full career. We've tried to give you a broad cross-section of Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, Navy, enlisted and officer. I guess I represent the only enlisted man among the whole group, as I was enlisted for 8 years before I ever became an officer. But there are a few things to share with you now with that background of what is the current situation and what is VASA involved with. I'm going to impose upon perhaps any questions that you might have to tell you a few things first, and then if you have questions, throw them at us in the minutes that are remaining. Behind me you see some pictures that were drawn by an LDS combat artist who spent his tour in Vietnam doing just what you see. He portrays in these pictures certain events that happened that he personally observed. The originals of these scenes now hang in the Army Museum of History in Washington, D.C. The one here is, he entitles, Provide for the Common Defense. All of these are available from the artist, who is a Utah artist. He lives down in Holden, Utah. His name is Frank Thomas. There are other stories, some marvelous experiences of military Mormon missionaries and their reactions to opportunities to exercise faith. Probably the most dramatic recent historical event are the number of LDS servicemen who were shot down and captured in Vietnam and spent years as prisoners of war. Now, by no means do we pretend, those who were in Vietnam, that that's the only war where LDS men were captured and served as prisoners of war. We're not that dumb to make that presentation. However, the most dramatic books that have been written of their experiences do come out of the Vietnam War. One of them is Larry Chesley, who's now serving as a bishop in Gilbert, Arizona. He wrote a book about his experiences, which is different than any other book concerning POW experiences in the Hanoi Hilton. His book is a book of faith, and how his faith and being a military Mormon sustained him in 7 years of brutal treatment. That book is out of print and is only available through those areas where you can find them. VASA happens to be one of those sources, if you're interested, and I did bring four copies with me. But without dwelling on the negative side, what VASA is trying to do is a positive healing of wounds. By that, we have a number of activities that we are involved with. In May of this year, we sent a team of four of us to Vietnam on a humanitarian assignment. We visited six hospitals and little clinics, two universities, kindergarten, visited many new economic zones, which is a euphemism. What's the best way to say that, Monty? In Utah would be a rural area where nothing grows and nobody lives, and it would be as though the state of Utah went down on the south and west side of this city, gathered up all the homeless and said, you can't stay in the city, we will now take you to your new home. Take them out to the alkaline desert out there and say, here you are, you've got 2,000 meters, do what you want with it. That's exactly what happens in Vietnam in the new economic zones. Monty Keller is one who went with that team in May. Marvelous experiences of seeing them say, them meaning people who a few years ago represent what we have all told you of our experiences of being in rocket attacks or being shot at or in combat, and Phil being hit by an incoming round right in his foxhole. We sat, the four of us, in May when we first got there on May 11th, sat across a table and lined up on the other side of that table were some of the meanest looking men we had seen in a long time. We were convinced that they had just a few years ago been looking down their gun sights at us. And sure enough, a couple of them had been Viet Cong commanders. That was our beginning when we arrived. 2 weeks later, when we left, the complete change of attitude, because they had never heard what is a Mormon. They had never known a Mormon. All they knew was that we were American veterans coming back to Vietnam with the desire to serve in humanitarian projects. 2 weeks later, they were very much aware of what a Mormon is from a number of reasons. Over here on this far, on my far left, is a plaque that one of those men carved by hand during 2 weeks, and he carved that scene off of a little business card. That's the logo of VASA, and the painting that's hanging behind me is the painting of the only LDS chapel ever constructed in Vietnam. It was built at the Bien Hoa Air Base by the LDS servicemen, completely without the knowledge of or the approval of the church authorities. They knew nothing about it. It just so happens that these LDS servicemen in 1965 said, hey, why can't we have our own chapel? Because they were having a heck of a time with the Protestant chaplain who was running the base and trying to schedule a time in the All Faiths Chapel to be able to meet in separate meetings. And the chaplain didn't want that. He wanted the Mormons to meet with the Protestants. Well, the Mormons said, fooey on that, and it evolved. They built that little chapel. On May 21st of this year, Monty Keller, myself, and two other VASA members received permission from the Vietnamese communist authorities of Dong Nai Province, where Bien Hoa stands, where the base is, the only Americans in 15 years given permission to go back on that base, and specifically given permission to walk through the base and photograph anything we wanted. That's a military security zone right now with the Soviets there. But we're the only ones who have been given permission to do that, and we had the privilege of walking back across those fields, that area that we know so well from our experiences in that little chapel. And we walked in through the rubble, the destruction, and the jungle growth that is now overrunning that whole area. The chapel, we are convinced, has been destroyed. And just before we left Vietnam, this People's Committee chairman apologized to us four times. And he said, we are sorry that your chapel and your church has been destroyed, but would you like to rebuild it? We will give you the land so that you can build it again. Now, that's quite a promise. Let me just share with you a couple other things very quickly. We have projects going on trying to help reunite families. 2 days ago, we received this letter. My name is Abraham Van Doe. I received your letter dated June 8, 1989. I've also received a letter from the ODP office regarding my application to the ODP program for my sister and her family. Mr. Tran Thong Nghia has been released from prison December 1988. I will send you a copy of the release certificate as soon as I receive it. I appreciate your time. Many thanks. This is a program that exists with the United Nations. Another man, an LDS member of the former Saigon branch, he sent us this letter, which I received in our mailbox 2 days ago, and then he called last night to inform me, since he wrote this letter, saying, please let me know about my daughter and my grandson and my wife. I need to know when they leave Vietnam, when they arrive in Bangkok, Thailand. Also, I need to know when they would arrive in the United States, the month and date. Thank you for your assistance. I appreciate. Enclosed my check. Well, then he called me on the phone last night at home and indicated to me that he had just received word from Bangkok that his family, after all these years, that he has not seen them since 1975, are leaving Vietnam on the 27th of September. We've been working, and we will not take credit in VASA. Please understand, we do not take credit for anything that we do, only that we serve. But we've been working with that particular case for over 5 years. This letter, which I will not read to you, is too long, is from the Decadana Corporation, which is one of the hosts that invited us to Vietnam and has invited us to come back anytime we want in several humanitarian projects. They are ecstatic
by what happened with our visit in May and the subsequent information. Now, of course, they want the whole United States to come back and do all these kinds of things, but they and the communist authorities there are talking not only about rebuilding the little chapel that you see here, but they are now saying, why don't you build a temple in Vietnam? Well, that's not our purview. VASA has nothing to do with ecclesiastical things. While we were in the service, in the military, there have been all kinds of opportunities for missionary activities. Whether it's direct missionary calls, such as Gordon received from Monty, who was our district president in Saigon, or whether it's just a casual way, there's always the opportunity to serve and live your religion, live your principles, without being obtuse about it, without making a lot of racket with the mouth. In Vietnam, there was a very great problem between the ranks of officer and enlisted. Gordon indicated in his comments some of those problems of fraternization between officers and enlisted. There were many tragedies that occurred because of some of those things, and I won't go into that. However, I will say that there was one member of the LDS Church who found a very unusual way to let others know that he was Mormon without opening his mouth to say anything. I personally experienced this because of what happened. As I was driving once back to my base at Bien Hoa in my old clunky Jeep, I passed going the other way a long line of military vehicles in a convoy who were stopped at a military checkpoint. And one of the things that used to be done with the Army guys, they were a little bit more flamboyant on some things. The Air Force was very cautious and reserved, right, guys? Right, yes. Yeah. All right, Roger, you got that grin. Anyway, the Army guys would have all kinds of way of doing things that they would paint under the dashboard or under the windshield some sort of a slogan. The hard to do, we do right now. Yes, sir, we can do it, or any kind of a slogan. Sometimes they were profane, sometimes they were obscene, sometimes they were hilarious, like the old Burma Shave signs along the road. Well, some faithful Latter-day Saint decided that he, by heck, was going to let it be known that he was Mormon. And so under the windshield of his Jeep, he painted, you can't see it from back there, but it says, Mahonrai Moriankumer. And that Jeep was in the middle of this great big convoy that was all stuck and jammed up going through the other direction as I was driving by, heading toward them. And I wasn't paying any attention other than I was reading these slogans and having a good time with it, and some of them, as I say, were pretty ridiculous. But when I saw that one, I went off the road, down into a ditch, up over past some minefield entranceways and so forth, and I really was having trouble controlling my Jeep because I was so excited. But I swung the Jeep around and came roaring back up against the traffic and stopped, jumped out and ran over to that Jeep. And the driver was an old, crusty Army sergeant with stripes down to his wrist and smoking a cigar that was at least 4 inches long. Big cloud of smoke around his head. And I said, Sarge, whose Jeep is this? And he said, expletive deleted, long string of profanity, blankety, blankety, blank, are you one of them? Now, see, that was missionary service. That's without having to preach anything. Another experience that we found out about in our files, by the way, in VASA, we have many, many, many of these stories, historical things. One Army pilot one time made an announcement one early morning over the loudspeaker system of his particular base, and he said, all Mormons gather at helipad 13 or whatever the number was. And soon there were a lot of young fellows with their weapons and battle dress and wondering what in the world is going on. Most of them didn't know each other. They just kind of showed up. And then as they were standing around wondering what was going on, here's a helicopter, a Huey helicopter with a blade turn. And an Army major in flight suit came up to the aircraft and said, are you guys Mormons? Yes, sir. Get in the aircraft. Well, one of the things about being in Vietnam is when somebody who outranks you told you to do something, you didn't stand there and go through a lot of yakety-yak, as we do here in this country, and debate the darned issue. You did it. So these guys, not knowing what's going on, grabbed their weapons and got on the aircraft. Kind of crowded in there. And aircraft took off, and when he was about 300 feet in the air, he just kind of hovered there for a while. And then he yelled over the noise of the engine. He said, "By the way, we're going to conference, district conference. We're going to church. Any objections? There's the door." And the first step is a killer, guys, 300 feet. They went off and flew down to Saigon and went to district conference. Glorious opportunity. It changed the lives of several of those young men who were on that aircraft because they had deliberately gone away from the church. But that experience of brotherhood in the uniform changed their lives. One last experience at Saigon, when we had a district conference that Monty Keller was conducting and our mission president from Hong Kong was presiding. As we drove up from Bienhoa with a big Air Force bus and a whole bunch of us in battle dress and so forth came off that bus, there was a group of Vietnamese teenagers across the street from the chapel watching all these crazy Mormons going in there and handshakes and all of that kind of stuff. And those Vietnamese teenagers started chanting, "Yankee go home, Yankee go home." Well, we had some hotheads on the bus. They heard this Yankee go home routine and they said, "Hey, Brother Kovalenko, do you mind if we go clean their clocks before conference?" And I said, "Well, we're not here to fight. We need to just go to church." We had our weapons with us because we had to be prepared. A lot of guys were stacking their weapons outside the door of the chapel. But these guys, these hotheads, wanted to go across the street and kind of have a little discussion with those teenagers who were chanting, "Yankees go home." Well, as they went across the street and headed toward them, fully ready to fight, the Vietnamese teenagers changed their chant. They added a couple of words. They said, "Yankees go home, but leave us the priesthood. Yankees go home, but leave us the priesthood." These were members of the church, Vietnamese, who had been converted by military involvement of their parents and the military missionaries. And that's what we left behind. That's what VASA has come into being to do, is to bring that experience back into reality. Now, in the minute or two that's left, anybody have a question, since we have just a few of you here? We'll try to answer anything that you want to ask.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment.
Yes, sir.
I think what you relate today is what the opportunity is for servicemen or civilians to do when they are in distant places or with other people. I was a pilot and an officer flying in World War II in the European theater. I'm an architect and past president of the architects and also past international president. I found wherever I went, if I represented myself as a Mormon, that information would elicit curiosity and questions about who I was and what my beliefs were. Two interesting things I might relate very quickly. When I was in a hospital in France, in Paris, France, doctor came, a doctor from Logan, and he said, "I understand, Dean, that you're a Mormon." I said, "Yes, we are." He said, "When you get out of this hospital, let's reorganize the church in Paris." And we started the first service on Sunday day in 206 Hotel. I went to the German prison camp, and I took a German enlisted man who played the organ and brought him to the church, and we had the first church service with 32 French people who had not had a church service since before the war had begun. Secondly, when I was national president, I was introduced by the incoming president. When I was going out, he said, "Dean and I are going over to a cocktail party." And he says, "Isn't that something?" He says, "A Mormon and I, a Catholic, going to a cocktail party, but of course you know Dean will not be drinking." So these were hundreds of people. And I think the point of it is that what you were doing also verifies my own experience through many years, that when we represent ourselves appropriately in the faith that we have,
thank you.
We do much of
that. Thank you for sharing that. And we'll be more than happy to hand you some of our brochure and welcome you, invite you to talk with us a little bit more after this time is over. There are a couple of us that have to leave immediately to get out to West Valley because of a radio program. The radio station out there has invited us to come. Let me just now make a couple of quick announcements. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering, from your experiences you seem to have a more working knowledge of the relationship between the physical and the spiritual. I'm just wondering if you would, anybody on the panel care to comment on a deeper understanding of that, and also if you think there's a lot of military metaphors that the Lord uses in the scriptures and in describing spiritual things, if you'd like to get into that at all.
Any of you? I think the best example of that is when you follow a standard procedure, and all at once that standard procedure becomes something totally what you would regard as inappropriate, and it's inspiration and direction. The spirit tuned, you receive promptings that you react to that are contrary to standard operating procedures. A point in case was my wingman was on fire. He punched the button, he said, "Sir, I'm on fire." My responsibility, according to standard operating procedure, was fire verified, bail out. I have a tally ho, we'll get a chopper in, we'll fly cap on you and go through the standard procedures. Instead, I punched the button and said, "Hang in there a minute, you're not smoking." I have this on tape, incidentally. He came back and says, "Roger that, sir, but it's getting hot as expletive in here, I want to get out." Why are you deviating? I could read his mind. Why are you deviating from standard operating procedure? Give me permission. He didn't really need permission, but he needed a verification that, yes, you're on fire. I do have you inside. When you do bail out, we have a chance of rescuing you. Once again, when he responded to that, he said, "Reach down for the ejection handles," and I told him to turn off his electrical. Well, there's about 40 electrical switches in the airplane. Being obedient, disciplined, he started turning off his electrical, and he thought to himself, "Colonel Weed has battle fatigue, obviously, because he's not responding properly." Well, as it turned out, if I had given him permission to bail out or had recognized the standard operating procedure, he would have been burned to a crisp by fire that was coming up over the canopy and would have entered the canopy the minute the canopy had opened. I was asking myself why I was giving those same instructions, but to me that's what you're talking about, is the spiritual versus the physical, and being in tune and responding properly to inspiration and direction.
The scriptures, of course, are very filled with not only military metaphor, but military realities. The Book of Mormon, experiences of Captain Moroni and Paran and the Patriot fighters, the sons of Helaman, and so on and so forth. The experience of Gideon in the Old Testament, and the reluctance to serve in a military assignment where he was directed to go out and literally slaughter an entire nation, and did not want to do that. Nephi and his reluctance to take life, which is a military situation. All of us could respond in great detail, I think, to what you've asked, and of course we're out of time. So we really can't get into a long dissertation of that except individually. Let me share with you a couple of things very quickly. I told you we'd have some announcements of some current projects. Right now under construction at the state capitol grounds on the west side is the Utah Vietnam Veteran Memorial, which is under construction. They need some folks to help with the guarding of that site during its construction, because there already have been threats against it by people who don't want to have a Vietnam memorial in the state of Utah. But anyway, it's under construction, and it's due to be dedicated, I think, in October, isn't it, Keith? October 14th. Also under construction, or at least being planned and the money is being raised, is a Utah Veterans Memorial Park, not just Vietnam, but anybody who served in the military from Utah. There's a memorial park being planned and constructed at Camp Williams. That is to be completed in the near future. Keith Haynes has a trek of welcome home that he is responsible for. And I just received this from Wayne Owen's office, and it's of interest to those who are concerned about Agent Orange and some of the bills in... Like many of you, I am outraged about neglected Agent Orange problems. On July 25th, the bill was introduced by Representatives Lane Evans and Martin Lancaster, which would allow for compensation to Vietnam veterans suffering from cancers or other ailments linked to Agent Orange exposure. I have joined them in co-sponsoring this bill. This legislation would require extensive research and analysis of all existing veteran health data. It would require the National Academy of Sciences to update the studies on Agent Orange victims every 2 years. The Department of Veterans Affairs would be charged to develop a benefit plan. I'm also co-sponsoring two other bills of concern to veterans. One exempt Agent Orange settlement payments from taxation as income, and another would provide assistance to Vietnam veterans who suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, and so on and so forth. So there is work going on. We appreciate the opportunity of being here with you, sharing our feelings and comments. Appreciate your patience in sitting through. If you have anything else that you'd like to talk with us about, you may. Keith, if you want to make any comment about the trek, you have about 7 minutes.
Basically, what is involved in the trek is it will be on Conference Weekend, which will start on Saturday. Second, it will be in each of the seven regions, and St. George, Kanab, and the Four Corners. Symbolism is a track to return home. Everyone has their own experience. Both Korean and Vietnam veterans had a situation where they never did receive the official welcome home. And this is something that is intended to be for all veterans, but we'll particularly focus on both Korean and Vietnam. On the next Wednesday, it will start at Wendover, and then it touches down to Vernal and over to Salt Lake. And on the northern portion, it will start in Scobell, down to Snowville, to Tremont, Lewiston, Logan, and Barton City, Devon, and over to Austin. Friday, the three northern routes will come together just in the Clearfield region. On Friday, the three southern routes will come together at Camp Williams. That will be a presentation. We're getting volunteers, asking some volunteers to cover. There'll be a national flag, state flag, and MIAPOW flag. And the volunteer will carry 5 miles. We'll be using a van to shuttle people back and forth. When they go through each community, the community will be given an hour and a half to have either a parade or a ceremony, so that the local veterans can be recognized. Those who want to be welcome to join the trek, and we'll go all the way to the dedication site of the Catholic Club. It's a special situation. Those who'd like to participate, we can give more information.
Thank you. Are there any other comments, questions, reactions? Yes, sir.
I just had a comment. In the service, it seemed to me, you have a unique opportunity to preach the gospel.
Yes, sir.
Just by being yourself, I maybe it was because I was in a Navy uniform flown from Air Force Base. Very long, so everybody on that base knew I was LES. And the COs were sending me, boys were having problems, counseling kind of thing. And one night in the BAA, pastor in the opposite quarters where comfort club. We had a party going and I had some 7-Up in my glass. And the colonel came over and he didn't say, "Captain Wallace, what have you got in that glass?" He said, "Lou, what's in that glass?" I said, 7-Up, sir." And he said, "It better be." So you are watched.
Indeed.
You are preaching constantly the gospel whether you want to or not.
Just before coming here, I will share with you that I had the opportunity of meeting the new executive secretary of the Church Military Relations Committee, who is also a Vietnam veteran, and we swapped a few lies and war stories, and that is the perception now, that there needs to be an awareness that serving in the military is not only an honorable profession, but you can serve anywhere you are by just who you are. And that's what we represent. Not to go back and relive all of the negatives and talk about that, but we want to get on with it and continue the work that we started many years ago in uniform. Thank you for your comment. With that, we'll now close this and make the room available for the next great mob that will come in here. Thank you for your attention. And thank you all panel members.